Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Ross Chambliss. Coming up, a conversation between Roger McDonough and author Richard Heimberg about the limits of economic growth. But first, a summary of today's top local headlines. Prosecutors said today no charges will be filed in a case of a customer who nearly died after unknowingly drinking iced tea mixed with chemicals at a suburban Salt Lake City restaurant. But Dickie's Barbecue isn't off the hook just yet. Jan Harding and her family will enter into mediation with the restaurant later this year to try to reach a monetary agreement, her attorney said. If that doesn't work, they'll file a lawsuit, he said. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is raising the bar for high school students enrolled in seminary, adding tests and reading requirements to a program that previously just expected attendance. Church-run seminary classes are geared toward students aged 14 to 18 and overview the Mormon scriptures in 50-minute daily sessions, typically held at home or in an LDS meeting house in the mornings before regular high school classes begin. Church officials say the new rigor should better prepare teenagers for their missionary assignments, which they can now take at an earlier age. The second of five Utah Debate Commission debates took place in Cedar City on Thursday night. Representative Chris Stewart had the task of defending his seat in the 2nd District from Democratic challenger Luz Robles, currently a state senator. The debate was largely congenial, but the candidates did differ on issues such as immigration reform, public lands management, and same-sex marriage. On the latter issue, Stewart voiced his personal opposition.
Marriage is between one man and one woman. That is my moral teaching, that is my faith teaching, and I don't know how I could possibly turn my back on that. I also believe there's another element to that, and that is I think the states have this prerogative to let them decide.
But Robles affirmed her support for same-sex marriage.
I know people have different opinions with regards to marriage, but at the end of the day, we are talking about human beings and children that belong to those families, and I know many of them are hurting.
Republican Representative Stewart assumed office after winning 62% of the vote in the 2012 election. Robles has served in the state Senate for Senate District 1 since 2009. This is her first run at the U.S. House. Senator Mike Lee represents Utah, but his name was brought up this week in the Colorado Senate race. So how is Lee involved in that race? KCBW's Roger McDonough posed that question to Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune, and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining me in the studio today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So Senator Mike Lee represents Utah, but he was brought up this week in the Colorado Senate race. How's he involved in that race?
So Congressman Cory Gardner of Colorado is up for with a new television ad charging that his opponent, Senator Mark Udall of Colorado, is to Washington to fix Washington. And he notes in this ad that Udall's dad, Mo Udall, ran for president and that he has two cousins in the Senate. Gardner doesn't say is that one of those cousins is Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who, as you might have seen or noticed in the last few years, isn't really a Washington insider. He's a Tea Party-loving politician, kind of like what Cory Gardner is. Udall's object to the ads attacking his family, kind of a low blow on the campaign. Should note that he didn't say Mike Lee's name on the ad, but it's very clear that he's one of the cousins.
Okay, but he's trying to avoid saying Mike Lee because Mike Lee has strong anti-Washington credentials.
You got it, exactly.
Interesting stuff. Speaking of Senator Lee, you reported that he was going to head to Europe soon. What's he doing there?
Well, hopefully having a better time than the Griswold family. look, Senator Big Ben, Parliament. Actually, the senator is headed on a four-city tour of Europe, starting with Paris to campaign against a U.S. law that seeks to essentially rat out Americans abroad who aren't paying their taxes. Lee objects to the law because he says it assumes people are guilty until they prove themselves innocent. There's a well-known conservative super lawyer James Bopp is leading this tour. Sadly, I've not successfully convinced my bosses to send me to Paris with the senator, but I'm still trying.
Well, if you get that junket, let me know and I'll go along with you.
Sounds good.
Finally today, some news that just broke yesterday. Attorney General Eric Holder is stepping down. How do Utah's elected officials feel about that?
So you might have guessed, Utah's members of Congress weren't the biggest supporters of the Attorney General. They've been pretty critical of Fast and Furious, the IRS scandal, a lot of the actions by the Department of Justice. But in this case, you know, when the guy's on his way out, they've been actually very nice. So, you know, Senator Orrin Hatch said, yeah, we may not have agreed all the time, but he really much thanked him for his service to the country. Representative Jason Chaffetz, who sparred many a time in the Oversight and Government Reform Committee with the Attorney General, said that, you know, he really respects what he's done. They may also not agree, but that, you know, it's good that he's been open and accessible. And actually, this is interesting. The former Utah Attorney General Mark Shurliff actually put on Instagram, that of all the attorney generals that he's attorneys general that he's worked with, that Eric Holder was the most committed to justice, equality, the rule of law, and very open and accessible. So you have Mark Sertliff who's praising Eric Holder. I'm sure he appreciates that.
I'm sure that Eric Holder is really happy about that as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So in the time that we have left, can we get a quick review of why the attorney general is stepping down? What were the reasons he gave for stepping down?
You know, he's been there, 6 years in the whole administration. It's just one of those times when he's served a long time and he can walk away and be happy with his service and they can get somebody else in. We can also note, if we want to talk politics for a second, he's resigning now because if the president wants to try to get somebody in the job before there might be a Republican-controlled Senate, it might want to do it this year.
Convenient to do it, just in case the Senate switches hands. And we can talk about the polls another time. Thomas Burr is a Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Roger.
I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is The Rundown. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Ross Chambliss. Now on the program, we turn to a conversation between KCPW's Roger McDonough and Richard Heimberg, a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and author of the books The Party's Over, Peak Everything, The End of Growth, and most recently, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Heimberg will be in Utah later next week for the Live More with Less conference of the Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance, which will be held at the Utah Valley University Science Auditorium next Friday, October 3rd. Roger spoke with Richard Heimberg via Skype.
Richard Heimberg, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's a pleasure, Roger.
You have written extensively on the finiteness of our energy resources and the consequences of that for our global economic system. But you're not talking about finite in any abstract way. You mean basically right now. And in fact, your 2011 book, The End of Growth, has a pretty easy to understand central premise, which is that economic growth as we know it is running into fundamental ecological barriers and that economic growth is dead. You know, I mentioned the fundamental barriers, but I guess to begin with, why do you say that growth is ending, and what is the data that we can draw on to back up that premise?
Right. Well, in the book, I suggest that there are three primary factors that are roadblocks to further economic growth of the kind that we saw during the late 20th century. And those three roadblocks are increasing cost of energy. It's true our gasoline prices have gone down a few cents in the last few weeks.
Right.
But, you know, we have to see that in terms of the bigger picture. Oil prices have gone up almost 10 times what they were. Right. Over the past decades. In other words, where we were paying $10 a barrel for oil back in around 1998-2000, over the last 15 years, price of oil has gone up to $100 a barrel. And that's had an enormous impact systemically throughout our entire economy. The second big factor is over-indebtedness. During the past few decades, starting in the 1970s, debt has grown faster than GDP. And I think in some ways we did this deliberately, although not entirely consciously, running up I'm not just talking about government debt here. I'm talking primarily about consumer debt, household debt, corporate debt. We increased debt so that we could consume more now and presumably pay for it later. Well, you can only do that up to a certain degree, and we seem to have hit real practical limits to debt. So since the crisis of 2008, the only category of debt that's really grown substantially is federal government debt. And that was done as a way of trying to stimulate the economy back into growth. And then the third factor is increasing costs from deteriorating environment. And much of that comes from climate change, weather storms, droughts, floods, that sort of thing. Also natural disasters related to the environment, everything from the Fukushima meltdowns of 2011 to the Deepwater Horizon disaster of the previous year. You know, we're just seeing more accidents and freak storms, and they're costlier as they happen. And if you chart that out and look at where that trend is headed, in just a few years, those increased costs will more than overwhelm the annual GDP growth that we would anticipate otherwise.
Some of this has to do with the kind of paradigm that we've belonged to for really not all that long, which is one of continuous economic growth on a planet with limited resources, as you've mentioned. Our economic system is something that I think a lot of us take for granted, but it's still relatively new, right? It has a lot to do with the fossil fuel era, which is also in its own right a really recent phenomenon, right?
Yeah, fossil fuels are amazing. When we discovered coal, oil, and natural gas, it was literally finding buried treasure. I mean, here were energy sources that were energy dense and portable, and that were extremely versatile. Imagine running your car on firewood, pulling off to the side of the road every once in a while to chop down a tree or to load up a quarter of a cord of wood and keep on driving. How much more convenient is liquid fuel from petroleum? And it's easy to take the benefits of fossil fuels for granted, but what we've done over the past 100 years is basically substitute cheap energy for human labor everywhere we possibly could. That's led to increases in labor productivity, basically people using more machines and less muscle power. And that's enabled us to build a consumer economy. And, the problem for economists for a long time was overproduction. With cheap energy, we could make consumer stuff in such quantities and so cheaply that people didn't know how to buy it all. So we invented advertising. We invented consumer credit as ways of soaking up overproduction. And now at the end of the day, energy is getting more expensive. And we've developed all these consumer appetites and the expectation of continuing economic growth. But the whole system is kind of starting to teeter and wobble, and we don't know what to do about it.
You write about the fossil fuels paradigm that we've been embedded in ever since those discoveries. In this way, you say, and I'm quoting here from The End of Growth, through the one-time-only process of extracting and burning millions of years' worth of chemically stored sunlight, we built what appeared for a brief shining moment to be a perpetual growth machine, end quote. And I remember reading that for the first time and having that aha moment about what fossil fuels really are, which is ancient organisms. It's akin to filling our gas tanks, you said with firewood, but I think of it as, dinosaurs or ancient ancient organisms. It's just amazing.
Well, it's not literally dinosaurs. Oil is mostly converted plankton and other minute oceanic organisms that proliferated, ironically enough, during a couple of brief periods of intense global warming, some 80 million to 150 million years ago. But however you look at it, this is millions of years worth of concentrated sunlight that we are digging out of the ground and burning as fast as we possibly can. And we've burned probably half of what we ever will burn just over the course of the last 50 years. So 50 years compared to those tens of millions of years it took to create that stuff.
And those resources are becoming a bit more scarce, or at least harder to find. And you write that this era of perceived endless growth is coming to an end, and we need to get used to it. But before I ask you about what's being done to get us ready for a no-growth future, I'd like to bring up a common argument from some economists when it comes to the finiteness of our ecological resources, which is that innovation and technological advancements will allow this growth to continue. Cold fusion and recycled cans will keep this bubble afloat. What do you say to that argument?
Right. Well, certainly we are innovative and we will come up with new technologies. The most obvious one is fracking. The U.S. is producing more oil today by, almost 3 million barrels than we were 5 years ago, 3 million barrels a day, I should say. And that's mostly to do with applying new technology, hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling, to producing oil from low quality reservoirs. Geologists call it tight oil. And so here's a success story. Here's an illustration of exactly what you were talking about. Right. But you know, you look deeper, and it's a race between the declining geological quality of the resource base on one hand, and the increasing sophistication of the technology of extraction on the other. Now, which of those two horses is going to win in the end? Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's going to be the declining geological resource base. But how's that going to play out? Well, we've done some research here at Post Carbon Institute. We bought the rights to the data on all of the currently producing tight oil and shale gas wells in North America. And we looked at initial production rates, you know, where that oil is and gas is, right, is coming from, location of each well, the trend in each well of production. And what we found is there's, you know, absolutely irrefutable evidence that this is a short-term phenomenon. U.S. shale gas and tight oil production will be in decline before the end of this decade. And in some cases, the declines are going to be pretty steep. Some of the plays where shale gas is being produced are already in decline. And in fact, the Marcellus play in Pennsylvania is the only one that's really showing much growth potential right now. So, you know, we like to talk ourselves into thinking that technology can solve all problems. But the reality is, you know, when you live on a finite planet, you have to deal with limits sooner or later. And I think it's going to be sooner rather than later. Hmm.
You know, Richard Heinberg, something that we've learned about human psychology is that people are resistant to change. I mentioned earlier that we take our economic system for granted to some extent, despite recent, calamities in the markets. The end of growth can sound like dire, dire stuff with big change consequences, the kind of stuff that makes a civilization want to stick its head in the sand even. but the mantra has been that economic growth is good for everybody. A rising tide lifts all boats. The things trickle down. I guess this is kind of all prelude to the question, is the end of growth that you're describing a bad thing?
Well, it's over the short term, it certainly will feel like a bad thing to a lot of folks. And certainly, you know, governments, politicians, and, you know, bankers and others are going to do everything they can to keep the growth machine going as long as it's physically possible to do so. But, you know, at a certain point, and that point, again, is probably not that far off, it's just not going to be possible. So we have to deal with that reality. And the fact of the matter is, we're not moving into some unprecedented territory here. A no-growth economy is not something that human beings have never faced before in world history. Right. It's the normal situation of human life. You know, for most of human existence on the planet, parents and their children and grandchildren maintained a way of life that was pretty similar from generation to generation. They didn't deal with, you know, a constant barrage of new gadgetry and new cultural memes that required each generation to kind of give up to obsolescence the minute the next generation came along. Right. So growth has brought social and psychological costs as along with its benefits. And so as we go back to the normal condition of a low growth or no growth economy, we could capitalize on a greater sense of security and intergenerational solidarity, a more predictable way of life. And if we do decide to capitalize on those potential benefits, you know, there's no reason that we couldn't find this transition or this transformation to our economy beneficial altogether over the long run.
You know, I think about this kind of cult of growth that we have here. I'm wondering, does the end of growth mean the end of our sort of economic system as we know it? Do you think that our sort of day-to-day lives will change dramatically in the near future as a result? I'm thinking, you know, in terms of going to the kinds of jobs we go to and the way you and I are communicating right now, all of that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, things are going to change. I'm not talking about something that's going to happen overnight, but over the course of decades, as we move away from relying on cheap, abundant, concentrated, portable fossil fuels toward reliance increasingly on more dispersed and intermittent energy sources like solar and wind, our daily lives are going to change. We're going to be consuming less energy. We'll be consuming energy not so much when the notion strikes us, but when the energy is relatively abundant, because these sources of energy are variable. Jobs, you know, we all know the old saying, butcher, baker, and candlestick maker. Well, over the last couple of decades, we've transitioned more to being, you know, the hedge fund manager, the IT consultant, and the real estate developer. Those kinds of jobs that are based on sort of manipulation of abstract symbols and quantities, those I think are going to play less and less of a role in our future economy. And in fact, more of us will be doing jobs that require us to have, you know, specific knowledge and understanding of our environment and how to make our way in our environment and perform real, direct, tangible services for one another.
How optimistic are you that those in political power who are making decisions about the direction that we're taking get this? And I guess also a follow-up to that is what kind of groundwork is being laid either inside or with or outside of our, you know, political systems around the world to make certain that our civilization is ready to transition out of the growth paradigm?
Well, I don't see too much public discussion of these kinds of issues among policymakers and politicians. And I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons that the public is losing faith in these folks. They're just so out of touch with reality. But where it is happening is on the ground. And I would point to, for example, the transition initiatives. This is something that started in Britain back in 2005, 2006, and it spread like wildfire all over the world. And it's community based, and it's also grassroots based. In towns and cities all over the world, people are getting together and saying, you know, look, this is the direction things are ultimately going. What can we do now in our communities, in our households, in our families, to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, to build a more local and equitable and functional and sensible economy among ourselves? Let's not wait for, you know, the federal government to do this for us. Let's figure it out on our own. And not waste any time. And so, you know, these transition initiatives start with a very positive premise. They say, well, look, let's assume life can be better without fossil fuels. How do we make that a reality? How do we get there? And the evidence that we're seeing so far is that, you know, there are lots of really practical projects that these initiatives are engaging in, and they're making a big difference in people's lives and communities.
Richard Heinberg, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's been a great pleasure, Roger.
And again, that was KCPW's Roger McDonough speaking with Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and the author of many books. He'll be featured next Friday at the Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance's Live More with Less conference at Utah Valley University next Friday, October 3rd. Find this and all of our past interviews at our website, kcpw.org. You can also find a podcast of this program on iTunes. I'm Ross Chambliss, and you're tuned into The Rundown. Stay with us. Thanks once again for tuning in to The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Roger McDonough with additional help from reporter Ryan Cunningham. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Join us every weekday evening at 5 p.m. for The Rundown here on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks once more for listening, and stay tuned now for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace.